I would always encourage people to spend time to get to know people in the firm that they're going to potentially invest with. I would always kind of ask, like, see how much access you have to the people, the decision makers.
This is Chan with The Plan, the podcast, a podcast providing career advice and easy, actionable steps for frustrated professionals, helping you overcome career challenges so you stop feeling confused and defeated and start feeling focused and confident in order to excel in your career. I'm your host, Max Chan. Now let's dive into the episode. Hey, Marcus, welcome to the show.
Hey, Max, thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to share with your audience.
We talked offline really quickly before we came on and recorded this podcast. You do have an interesting story. You spent over 20 years in the military, but while you were doing that, you were building your real estate portfolio. And then once you left the military, you started really focusing on it full time and you're getting the right partners to really accelerate your real estate portfolio. Now, again, I don't want to give your whole story away with my summary here. So why don't you tell us more about like your background? What made you decide to get into the military in the first place?
Yeah, and I appreciate that, Max. So, you know, I mean, I guess going back to that question, that goes obviously back. I went to the military a couple weeks out of high school. So taking me back a couple of decades here now, you know, as I was getting towards the end of high school and really I was looking at going to college and I had always done well in school and everything, but I didn't know what I wanted to do, you know, at the time. And I didn't want to spend a lot of time in school, not having kind of a path forward and stuff. And so I had a number of influencers in my life, you know, within the family, as well as friends and things like that, that were in the military. And you know, I saw some opportunity there. And initially I was kind of like, you know what, I'll do 4 years. It'll give me some time to kind of decide, you know, what I want to do with my life a little bit. And in reality, instead of answering many questions, it opened up more doors and opportunities. And so, you know, 21 years later is when I finally made my transition out. But that's how I kind of got into the military in the first place.
You stayed there for over 20 years. I'm not sure what the average is and like how long people stay in the military, but why don't you tell me more about like your military career and what made you stay as long as you did?
Yeah. So when I originally did, you know, I enlisted in the Navy right out of high school and I went in as a cryptologic technician. So did a lot of like IT networks on classified networks and things like that. And ultimately, you know, in that first enlistment, I had some opportunities that opened up. I ended up applying for a commissioning program and I was selected as a cryptologic warfare officer. So doing like signals intelligence, kind of the same similar stuff I was doing on the enlisted side, but it provided the opportunity for me to go back to school. So the military paid for my education. I went back to the University of Missouri, so go Tigers. You know, it opened up that door and that opportunity for me to get some additional education. And from there, I continue to have just like kind of unique experiences and opportunities. You know, I had a number of tours on ships and submarines, worked on Admiral staff. I worked at aerospace data facilities. My final tour was actually as an exchange officer to the United Kingdom. And so, you know, once I made that, I decided to stay after that first enlistment in the military and got my commission. And of course, you know, they paid for additional education and masters and things of that nature. But really, just like I enjoyed the mission that I was doing. I had the opportunity to work with a lot of unique individuals from various different places in the United States, various different cultures. And, you know, outside, you know, many of the people, the military is a very diverse organization in many ways. And the opportunity to do that, to get to travel to a number of countries. And so I kind of just kept continuing to stay in and, you know, doing additional roles and stuff until family started to kind of play a role in that. I now have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. And so when they were a little bit younger, you know, that kind of started playing the role of when I decided to make the transition out of the military.
Yeah, that makes sense, right? Because in the military, you do travel a lot. You're away from home a lot. So now seeing your kids grow up, that's probably a big factor on why you decided maybe it's time to step away.
Absolutely.
In terms of the real estate portion of your career, how did that come about? How did you start dabbling your foot into real estate during the military?
Sure. So, you know, going back into the story there, whenever I got selected for the commissioning program and I went back to the University of Missouri, I was probably 22-ish at the time. And so that's when I bought my first real estate for myself. So I lived there personally. And that was kind of house hacking. And, you know, I don't know if your audience knows, but, you know, it's essentially like renting out a room or things like that to someone else. And probably before the term house hacking was really kind of coined or came along. But, you know, so I did that. And when I left, when I got my degree from Mizzou and left, I continued to keep that property as a rental property. And, you know, things kind of started clicking, you know, for a mid 20-year-old. I was like, oh, that's cool. You know, most of my mortgage was paid for by having people rent rooms. And then whenever I rented it out, you know, I continued to cash flow and things like that. So, and I was a finance major, right? So I kind of had like a finance mindset and things of that nature. So over the coming years, you know, I had a number of operational tours, right? And, you know, submarines and ships and stuff. But during that time, I continued to buy a number of other investment properties, not like at a high rate or anything like that. It was kind of opportunistic, mostly kind of back in Missouri where I grew up near my hometown and things of that nature. So I just over a number of years continued to kind of slowly acquire additional, mostly like long-term rental properties and a couple of small commercial buildings, cattle farms, so various things. But it was fairly opportunistic early on, but just steadily added new investment properties to the portfolio.
In terms of, like you said, you being a finance person, like there's obviously different investments that someone can make, real estate, index funds, stocks, I guess like 401k in the state side. If someone's looking to invest right now, what are some of your recommendations, whether it's doing the real estate or whether it's doing like investments in like stocks or 401ks or Roth IRAs? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the most important things, right, is understanding what people's goals are from investing. And a Roth IRA example is just a medium in which you can, like you can invest in stocks through your Roth IRA. You can invest in real estate through your Roth IRA, right? So that's just a tool and stuff to do so. Like I used to invest in stocks and bonds myself a lot more than I do today. I've transitioned a lot of that to real estate. And a lot of that just has to do with, you know, I think that me personally, that real estate has a lot more ways in which you can, you know, that I appreciate the benefits of it, whether that is from forced appreciation, from cash flow, from some of the tax benefits. And I think there's more ways to benefit from than many just like funds, you know, or stocks is what I should say. And so that's why I've transitioned significantly towards there. But even within real estate, right, there's a lot of different strategies. And so you really have to understand what someone's goals are. You know, are they looking for cash flow? Do they have plenty of cash flow from either, you know, their W-2 or other means, and they really just want the growth? Do they need, you know, tax benefits? So even within the number, you know, if you're looking at short-term rentals, long-term rentals, I've transitioned largely into commercial real estate, multifamily, you know, much larger than what I was doing when I was doing single family stuff. So there's a number of different strategies that you can do. And some of them have different, you know, benefits, or some of them, you know, cash flow more, or some of them are might have better tax benefits. And so you really have to kind of, on an individual basis, understand what someone's goals are and what they're trying to get out of the investment to kind of determine what's the right thing for them.
And in terms of like real estate risk, obviously it's not as simple as you find a property, you buy it, you maybe renovate it just to first off up the value, but then also like make it more attractive to renters. Obviously, like if there are repairs, you have to like account for those. But what are some other risks that many first-time real estate investors aren't aware of?
You know, again, depending on like what you are investing in, right? Like when I initially was investing through most of my military career, as I mentioned, I was kind of doing single family properties, where I was buying them as long-term rentals. You know, now the properties that I'm acquiring with my partners are 100 unit properties or whatever, you know, $10 million plus dollar properties. You know, some of the risks are very similar. Some of them differ depending on like what kind of, you know, investment that you're getting into. If, you know, on the single family side, like really, or regardless, actually on either side, just like understanding like the market, right? So I was primarily investing long distance, as you can imagine, like being military, moving around every 3 years. But that's not so different than a lot of other real estate investors as well, right? Sometimes the place that you live in, the state or something that you live in, may not be the most optimal place to invest, you know? And so you look for a long distance market or something. So understanding the market is very important. And so for us, you know, when we're acquiring properties, like many of them not necessarily in the market that I physically live, but understanding like what are the other market rents there, right? Like what are the other commercial, the multifamily properties renting their rooms for? How well do ours like compare to theirs? Are they kind of similar vintage, similar class apartments, you know, making sure that we're comparing apples to apples, you know, understanding like what the insurance rates are, like those can be very different for commercial real estate in Oklahoma as they are to real estate in Florida. You know, I think that, you know, for us, you know, now like I'm an active partner on many of these multifamily, and we have a lot of passive investors, right? So whether you are an active investor buying a single family yourself, or you are a passive investor who is relying on an active investor like myself, like the general partner, making sure that you have someone that is doing the work and doing the due diligence. Because like the US is a very broad country, right? And so the different markets can be very different. They're not all the same.
In terms of like the mental like fitness when it comes to like buying all these properties, I'm assuming that you're not buying them all in cash. I'm assuming there is a mortgage, at least when you start off with the single family homes. So in terms of like risk tolerance, when did you know that you were ready to buy another property and improve that cash flow?
Yeah. So, I mean, early on, like when I was first buying single family and stuff like that, I think that as I kind of saw that first property, the equity start to kind of build up, I was able to buy that first one with a VA loan, you know, being military myself and stuff. So didn't necessarily have to have a lot of capital down. However, you know, as I kind of saw, you know, someone else kind of paying the mortgage down and things like that, and I had cash and stuff like that for myself, but I also started like looking at ways that I could use my equity in that first property, whether, you know, cross collateralization or whether a line of credit against an investment property when I had the capital to make a down payment on the second property, or even like starting as I kind of got education through other ways, kind of learning ways in which you may not have to put as much down and, you know, you might have a little bit more leverage, but trying to find that right balance between using less of your own money and, you know, where your risk tolerance is for having additional leverage.
Speaking of like using less of your own money, that's when the partnerships come about, right? So when you start off in real estate, you were investing with your own money, a single investor. What was the tipping point in terms of getting partners to start investing in bigger and better building?
Yeah. So, you know, as I got towards the end of my career, and I'd partnered up, you know, with a couple brothers, like onesie twosie, was with some single family properties and stuff. But where it really escalated is as I got towards the end of my military career and, you know, looking forward, like I didn't want to go to work for, you know, a W-2 or have a 9-to-5, you know, I had kind of an entrepreneurial, you know, mindset and stuff. And having already been in real estate for a number of years at this point in time, decided that real estate was going to be the direction that I went. But as I mentioned, there's a number of different strategies and a lot of what I had done up to that point was kind of opportunistic. And so I knew I needed to be more systematic about it. And so ultimately that's kind of when I looked at a number of different options and decided to go to the route of commercial real estate, specifically multifamily, you know, apartment, residential, you know, properties like that. And I had a number of friends, you know, I've been a couple like masterminds. So I, you know, had some mentors and other people that I could talk about some different things and ended up partnering with a few people that were also doing this within those masterminds. And I met with them on a weekly basis and saw them kind of doing it and decided that that was the direction that I was going to go. And so those properties, as I mentioned earlier, like many of those are, you know, say 100 units, you know, like a $10 million purchase and still similar to like personal residence, you know, we still get a mortgage on them for, you know, 60, 70% like loan to value. The amount is sometimes less than the loan to value they'll put on a commercial property like that is less than most of our residential personal residence mortgages. But, you know, and then we raise a lot of the additional capital for the down payment, as well as capital expenditures and things like that from passive investors. And I think it's, you know, it was a really unique opportunity, you know, as I learned about it, because as I was making the transition out, like I was thinking of many of my peers in the military who would love to be, you know, have exposure to or invest in real estate, but they might still be active duty. You know, maybe they were moving around a lot. Maybe they were living overseas. Maybe they didn't enjoy real estate as much. They wanted exposure to it from an investment, but they didn't necessarily want to take the time to learn it all. And so I got a lot of fulfillment and satisfaction out of being able to provide, and I still do, like out of being able to provide these like passive opportunities to a lot of my friends, right? And so I've partnered up with, you know, some really good teams and partners who are very good at analyzing the markets, analyzing these like larger properties, you know, doing the acquisitions and really asset managing the properties and stuff as well. And so not only is it a way for us to acquire larger properties, you know, some people think like, oh, you know, we go down the street and see these apartment complexes and we think, you know, just like uber wealthy people have acquired them. And the reality is like a lot of them are owned by, you know, groups of people like ourselves. And so it was just really rewarding for me, not only to be able to educate some of my peers and stuff about this opportunity, because some people don't know that it exists for them, but to bring these opportunities to them as well.
In terms of like the partnership agreement, like how does it work? So I'm assuming you have your own like real estate investment firm, and then like you would be like the leader in terms of managing it. So would you always have like the majority share of the equity of the property, and then everybody else who wants to buy in will have a smaller percentage? Is that how your model works?
So for a lot of like, so we do what's called a syndication a lot of times. And so within the act, you know, there's two sets of partners, right? There's like the active partners or the general partners, and there are passive partners or the limited partners. And often when you look at the entire thing, the more of the equity is actually given to the passive investors because they bring a lot of the capital into that property or to that specific investment, right? And then we as the general partners take a more minority share of the entire investment. We may bring in some of our own capital as well, but that minority share of the equity is for the work that we're doing, right? To analyze the market, to analyze the properties, the relationships with brokers, lenders, and the negotiation, all of that stuff, and the asset management. And so, the general partners, I have my own investment firm, right? And you might do that on your own. You might build up your own company and have that entire like 30% as an example. Or in some cases, there's a number of us that, you know, are small companies that partner together as the general partners, right? So there may be three or four partners that partner together to make up those active partners and kind of divide those roles of analyzing properties, underwriting them, raising capital, managing the asset, things of that nature. And so when we acquire it, you know, that split might be 70% of the equity is with the limited partners, the passive investors, 30% of it is to the general partners or the active investors.
In terms of partnerships, like how do you find the right partners to invest in? Because like, there is a lot of money at stake, right? So finding a bad partner could ruin you potentially. So in your case, when you started to get into partnerships, how did you find a partner that's a good fit from both like a financial and from a collaborative perspective?
Thinking first on like the collaborative perspective kind of, and like the other active partners that I was working with, there's a variety of ways to do this, whether they are, you know, a couple of my partners, as I mentioned earlier, came from with inside masterminds. You know, I was inside a mastermind that was for active duty and veterans that was real estate, I would say entrepreneur real estate focused, you know, people doing some different strategies and stuff. I'm also, you know, in masterminds that are specifically focused on multifamily now and stuff. And so in some of these masterminds at times, I would spend time with people every week, you know, week in and week out, you get to know people over time. And I think that's one of the important parts is, you know, not to rush into partnerships. So whether you're spending time within a mastermind, whether you're spending time, you know, maybe it's someone you go to church with, or, you know, you work with in your W-2 at the moment, or wherever it might be, is just to take time and have conversations about business stuff. Because even if it's somebody that you know, maybe from on a friend level, maybe you've known them a little bit longer, you know, things can be a little bit different in business. And so sometimes, you know, two people have an idea and you're like, let's both do this and let's partner up and do it together. You know, I think it's still really important, even if you've known each other for a while, to kind of have some of those tough conversations and, you know, hey, what does this look like? What kind of commitment do you have to the partnership? Because sometimes people still have, you know, a W-2 or a family or whatever. And it's not always as easy as, hey, let's just do 50-50, right? Like sometimes there's one person that's going to be putting more into the business and stuff. And so I think you have to have some of those tough upfront conversations going into it so that when you are faced with them, you've already kind of had the conversation, hopefully, or know how each other are going to react or approach that. So, you know, I think that was for me, you know, a lot of my partners did come from those kind of groups where I was spending time with people a lot. Like some of them kind of came during COVID and stuff as well. And, you know, a lot of those like meetups and stuff went to Zoom. And the same people would be showing up to that meeting every single week, right? And so you got to spend some time and get to know them. On, you know, from a passive perspective, and like those partners, our partners that are kind of bringing a lot of our capital and stuff. And, you know, sometimes, you know, if someone's never raised capital before or anything, they might think like, if someone has capital and they want to bring it, why wouldn't they be a good partner? I think you still have to, as I mentioned earlier, like, what are those individuals' goals, right? Does our business plan, does our strategy align with what their financial and their family goals are, right? And so I spend a lot of time to educate and to inform potential passive partners and have those conversations and try to get to know, you know, what they're trying to get out of it. Because if what they're looking for in an investment is not what our investment provides, or, you know, maybe like timelines don't line up, you know, I don't want them to invest in our opportunity. Because, you know, once they do, if their expectations aren't managed or it's not in alignment, they're going to be disappointed, right? And they're going to be upset, or maybe they thought they're going to get their money back sooner than they are. And so that doesn't make a good partnership, right? So I think similarly, for the passive investors, just kind of communication, open communication, and transparency, both on what we do, what we provide, and like what they are looking for and to get out of an investment.
In terms of like partnering with other people, is there like an out clause, or they have to hold that money in the property for a certain amount of period of time? Like, is there like a buyout phase?
It is possible to get out. It is not very easy, right? So legally, once they invest, most of the time our business plans are about 5 years plus or minus and stuff. And so once they, essentially when they invest, they are investing, you know, we create a new LLC or a new company for each property or portfolio of properties that we are acquiring. And when they invest, they're essentially investing or in part like ownership, not just of the real estate, but ownership of that company, you know, 1%, 2%, 3% of that new company that we've created. And so it's not very liquid, right? And so that's important for them to know that it's not like a savings account or money markets that they can just, you know, say when they want their money back or things like that, you know. So it's not very liquid. It's possible.
Has there been an issue where someone wanted to invest and then like something happened with their personal life and they need the money and they asked you for it and then you said no? And was there a huge like conflict? Has that ever happened to you over your years of investing in real estate?
Yeah. So that has not personally happened to me. I am certain that it has happened to people that do, you know, very similar things in the business. And, you know, that's one of the things, the communication and clarity early on so that they understand what situation that they're getting into, right? So I'm sure that there are some of my investors that have potentially, maybe something came up, they had another opportunity or things of that nature where they would have liked some of the capital or could have used it or whatever, but not so like dire straits that they came to ask or they knew that they were in it for the long run, you know? Yeah, I think the other thing too is like a lot of times we have a minimum investment in what we do. And so, you know, in the industry, you might see like $50,000 is pretty standard minimum. You know, you might see 25, you might see 100. But two, one of the reasons amongst a few others, there's a reason for that minimum, is that most of the time, you know, if someone can afford to invest that minimum, they can afford for it to be gone for a while. Whereas, you know, if you have a minimum of like 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 or something like that, and that's what someone could afford to invest in it, they might be in a position where if something happened, you know, maybe they have a car wreck or whatever and they need to fix the car, they might tend to need that money back sooner, you know, than someone that can afford to invest the 50,000. So there's some ways we go about that to try to, you know, communication wise and structure to avoid that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's a great way to like weed out people that want like the instant gratification of an investment. But yeah, like again, as you said, if your minimum is 10,000, there might be a good chance that if something happens, they might need the money. But if someone has like $50,000 or $100,000 lying around, they probably have way more high of a net worth that's not really going to matter to them in the long run. In the short term, or where they might need the money. In terms of like someone trying to get into the real estate market and invest, they might not be able to have money to invest on their own. What is your recommendation there in terms of someone's getting the real estate market, but they don't have a big down payment to buy their own property? What's your suggestion on that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when we look at, and this is, you know, true for real estate or other business and things like that as well. Like in order to buy real estate, you know, you need time, money, knowledge, you know, kind of that triangle of things, right? And so maybe if someone doesn't have money to invest, then perhaps they have time, or maybe they have knowledge, right, where they can still bring value to a group or a partnership, you know? And so, like I said, this applies whether you want to get into real estate to acquire some, or whether you want to partner in some other way as well, right? So, you know, as an example, and you have to think about, I hate to say think outside the box, but like think about what skills people have or what value they can add to other people, right? So even if you are, maybe you don't have a ton of real estate knowledge yet, but you want to gain some or you want to provide value, like maybe someone knows how to make websites really well or something, right? And so maybe someone that's in real estate needs a new website. So how can you offer? Is there something that they need that you can trade, you know, for some knowledge or whatever? And so I think, you know, when you look at that triangle of time, knowledge, and money, if you don't have the money, like what is it from a knowledge perspective that you can offer, or from a time perspective that you can potentially offer? And that's why having, you know, networking and having conversations and understanding both what other people need as well as what you can offer is important, because, you know, perhaps if the skill sets or things that you offer are not a need for the other person, maybe it's not a good match, but there is likely something that you can offer. Maybe like, you know, they teach you how to do something one time and then you have the time to execute that and it frees it up for something, you know, for them that they don't have to do that anymore.
partnering in real estate is similar to like partnering in terms of like starting a business. So like for you, like what were some of like the vetting like criteria that you had in terms of finding right partners to invest in your commercial properties?
Yeah. So I think, you know, certainly just kind of like an alignment of values and stuff, you know, like through conversation. And, you know, when I think, say, a commercial property, a lot of my partners really, you know, prioritize even our residents and like not just like putting a roof over their heads, but making those properties like a community. You can see that through the interaction from our asset managers to our property managers who are there day to day, you know, the resident events that we hold, just the way they interact with people, the, you know, the surveys we do with our residents to try to take into account what they want to see at the property. And so I think, you know, just having those like similar values and the business approach, like there's some people that might not do that, right? They're not as concerned that the residents are just a number to them. They're just looking at the bottom line for their investors. And we try to balance the two, you know, our focus on doing the right thing for the residents and also the right thing for our investors. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that is kind of the core thing. And, you know, to the best that you can, understanding what people are going to do, you know, when things go bad, because there's going to be times that things don't go, you know, as planned. I think one of the other things in partnerships too is, you know, a few minutes ago, I mentioned understanding what other people need and what you can offer, right? And so I think it's important for us to know, like, what are our skill sets and our interests, right? Like, if we do something that we are good at and or like we are interested in, you know, we're going to show up better for our partners. And what we don't need is three or four people on the team that are all good at the same thing, you know, and not complementary skill sets, right? And so we might be best friends, but if the two of us are very good at the exact same thing and we still have gaps in what we need, that doesn't necessarily make the best partnership, right? And so, you know, when we look at roles in our commercial stuff, you have people that are doing acquisitions, you know, they're out there talking to brokers or sellers. We're doing underwriting, the, you know, the analytics in the spreadsheets. We're doing capital raising, talking to investors. We're doing asset management, you know, the day-to-day, the execution of the business plan and talking to the property managers. And so those take different skill sets, right? Like someone might really love spreadsheets and analyzing numbers, but maybe they don't love having conversations with potential investors, or maybe they don't love having conversations with brokers. And so I think that's important to understand, like, who has what skill sets and what you bring to the table and how they complement each other before you kind of take off together. Because if we all like doing the numbers, no one likes talking to potential investors. Well, we might analyze a lot of properties, but we don't have the capital available to acquire them and stuff, right? So
when it comes to like real estate investing, you're not going to invest in the winner every single time. Was there ever an issue where you had to sell a property because it was just bleeding money? And if so, when do you realize that it's not good to hold on? It's better just to sell and take your losses than seeing if it rebounds.
Yeah. So I would say that that's kind of happened on some of the single family stuff. I wouldn't say, you know, most of our, you know, multifamily and stuff is in a pretty good position, or like when we analyzed it initially, we tried to do conservatively enough to take into account for things not going quite as well and give us a little bit of a buffer. However, I would say, you know, some of my single family, certainly, especially, you know, some of them I was investing long distance, we acquired some probably quicker than we were ready for at that phase in my entrepreneurial journey, if you will, even though I was still in the military at the time. Some of them were like, I bought them and they were ready to rent, right? They just needed a little bit of work and they were essentially ready to rent. There were a few that I acquired that needed a little bit more work than we realized, right? Until we had already bought them and got in, we're like, okay, this needs a little bit more capital. And so maybe we hadn't quite accounted for enough upfront capital, or we didn't necessarily have like contractors lined up to do the amount of work that was required. And so we had a little bit of a longer hold period, and, you know, maybe the interest and stuff like that started to build up and it took more. And so there were certainly some, you know, of those properties that didn't quite go like as planned, but that was also part of my journey that, you know, shifted me towards multifamily and stuff as well, because I had some of these experiences with some single family properties, and I learned a lot of lessons as far as like analyzing properties and stuff like that as well. But that was part of what led me to multifamily. And really, in reality, we didn't take necessarily massive like financial losses on those single family properties, but, you know, even if I broke even financially, I lost a lot of headspace, you know, or, you know, some, opportunity costs there from the time that we spent in doing them. And as I got into multifamily, I offloaded most of those single family properties just because the amount of time they took me individually, it wasn't worth it for me anymore when I could spend, you know, that time on a larger commercial property.
In terms of like your military career and your real estate career, what were some of the mindsets or best practices that you had in the military that made you a successful like real estate investor?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a couple things that come to my mind pretty quick. I think that one of them is, you know, in the military, we don't always have like all of the resources that we need, right? We're always, you know, given these missions and like do more with less. And, you know, but we have kind of a can-do attitude. You know, we're just asked to execute a mission, but we're given, you know, three of the 10 resources that we actually need to execute it. We figure a way out to do it, right? And so I think that that has translated a lot into to real estate or even entrepreneurship and stuff in general. You know, we'll just kind of, you know, we don't sit there and be like, oh, I don't have everything. I need to do it. We go out and we get the resources, we find the resources, we find the right people to make it happen. So I think that's one thing. Another one I think is just the ability to be flexible or to pivot if we need to, right? So in the military, we often spend months and months and months training for, you know, a certain area of the world or a certain mission. And then some world event happens. And at the last minute, we end up going somewhere else, or we end up executing a mission that we weren't training for the last 6 months or something, right? And so we joke around about it a lot in the military. You know, we know if we get like a good steak dinner or something, bad news is about to happen, or they're about to change the plan on us or something like that. So I think that comes into play in real estate and entrepreneurship and stuff as well, right? Because we have a business plan, and at some point there's something's going to come up that was unexpected, whether it's with our, you know, property manager, or maybe there's a fire at the property, or there's a tornado, or whatever it might be. And we have to deal with those things. And so I think just the ability to be flexible and, you know, kind of move as those things happen, especially those things that are uncontrollable.
It's not about lack of resources, it's about being resourceful, right?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Going back to the control and uncontrollables, they focus so much on the uncontrollables, but focusing on the uncontrollables will give you a lot of anxiety and stress. It's about focusing on what you can control. If you take action on things that you can control, it tends to work out in your favor anyway.
Yeah, 100%. Like, you know, even like when we're like analyzing properties from a numbers perspective, like we have the uncontrollables in there, right? Like taxes and insurance and stuff. And sure, I can call around and get a few different insurance quotes or whatever, but like, ultimately, a lot of them are going to be, you know, pretty high or whatever. But the things I can control a lot more are some of the other expenses, you know, from operations or things of that nature, or like, you know, what can we put into the business plan to control that? So even when we're analyzing from a numbers perspective, you know, we have that kind of broken up into controllables and uncontrollables and stuff. So yeah, you're going to get, you take into account the uncontrollables, but really the focus area is what we can control and what we can do about those.
To like wrap up our conversation today, Marcus, if like someone is trying to get into the real estate market, what would be a good first step for them to explore that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, like I said earlier, like real estate is extremely broad and the different, you know, strategies that are available. But I think the first step for them is to understand what they're trying to achieve from it. Are they looking for immediate cash flow? They have plenty of cash flow and they're looking for growth. Are they needing some tax benefits and stuff? So understanding what their own family and financial goals, and I say family goals too, because there's a lot of ways to be active as a real estate investor, and there's ways to be passive as a real estate investor, right? And so when I say like family goals or individual personal goals, like, do they actually enjoy real estate? Do they want to get into it and get their hands dirty and do stuff? Or just do they just want to invest and have exposure, but not really be, you know, hands-on? So I think the first step is, you know, kind of outlining and understanding those things. There's a lot of educational resources, podcasts, books, all that kind of stuff. But if nothing else, you know, if you have someone in your network, hopefully that knows some of the different strategies, you know, reach out and have a conversation with them, because that's what I love doing with my network, right? Like, is educating them on the pros and cons of these different strategies and how they align with whatever their goal is that they've determined, and helping, you know, them take the next step. And maybe that is an investment with us, and maybe it's not.
Speaking of which, so let's say this person is researching a bunch of real estate investment firms. What are some of the questions they should ask or criteria they should evaluate before they make a decision? Because again, like, even if, let's say you do have 50 or 100K lying around, you do want to make sure that you are entrusting someone that will be able to handle your money properly.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's, you know, I could probably provide a list of hundreds of questions that are worth asking over time and stuff, you know, but for the sake of time, you know, most of my investments that I did passively myself, as well as many of my own, about 75% of my investors are military right now. So many of them I've had a relationship with over time and stuff. And so I would always encourage people, you know, to spend time to get to know people in the firm that they're going to potentially invest with. I would always kind of ask, like, see how much access you have to the people, the decision makers, right? Like, I talk to my investors on a pretty routine basis. You know, that's one of the downsides when you get like larger and larger and larger firms. You know, how much time do you have, like, access to anyone in the firm, and particularly people that are closer to the decision makers? You know, looking for, you know, track record in the past, whether, you know, that is properties that they've exited or the kind of the metrics on properties that they are 2, 3, 4 years into business plans right now. And, you know, maybe communication. I think communication is a big one. And so, you know, asking like how, you know, frequently and what mediums or modes they communicate with their investors. Like, we tend to, you know, send out monthly communication at a minimum, and, you know, often do like quarterly webinars and things like that. So different firms have different styles of doing that, but you should know kind of going into those investments when and how you will be hearing from the firm about your investment. So those are 2 or 3 quick ones off the top.
You said the minimum length of an investment in real estate is 5 years, right?
Well, not necessarily in real estate in general. I mean, in most of our business plans, you know, my firm's business plans are usually around 5 years, because we are acquiring, you know, a apartment complex, and we are going to reposition that apartment complex, you know, whether through creating efficiencies in operations or upgrades and things like that. And then we will look to sell or to recapitalize. But, you know, you could get into shorter term. There are people that are, you know, doing, you know, flipping houses or things like that. I look at that more as a job, you know, full time and stuff, more so than an investment. But it's in real estate industry. But you could do private lending, right, for people that are flipping, which could be 3, 6, 12 months lending and stuff. So there are certainly shorter options and ways to invest and get connected with real estate that aren't 5 years long. Some of those different strategies may not all have the same benefits, right? And so that's why it's important to kind of talk to somebody and understand. It might be more liquid. You might get your money back sooner, but maybe it doesn't have all the tax benefits or something like that. So it's always important to kind of understand what the pros and cons of each are.
The other question I wanted to ask was, like, you don't get your return on investment until you sell the place, right? Like, or can they also buy you up, but you still keep the property? How does that work?
Yeah, so we actually do distributions. So usually about 6 months into an investment, we will start providing distributions to our investors, and then quarterly thereafter. And then if we refinance or sell the property, there would be a much larger sum. But they do get some capital back. And that kind of can depend on the business plan and stuff as well, right? If you're doing something like a development that, you know, you're first putting a lot of money into it development wise, but there's no income because there's no renters, then you may not get those distributions. It may all come on the back end. But if you're buying something that is already stabilized, you know, maybe it's 95%+ occupancy and there's rent, you know, it's cash flowing from day one, then there will be distributions throughout the course of the investment. Still, like, a large percent of it does often come on the back end, but you'll get some throughout the entire investment often.
Got it. Okay, Marcus, this is an enlightening conversation in terms of, like, real estate investing and how you were able to pivot from the military into real estate. So for someone who wants to know more about your real estate investment firm, or just want to know more about, like, your transition from, like, the military into real estate, how can people reach out to you to learn more about that and connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So probably the best place is to go to alonglegacy.com. And on there, there's a calendar on there if you want to schedule a call, time to set up a chat or shoot me an email. My social media, all that kind of stuff is on there. So if you are interested in hearing more about my transition, you know, challenges that I went through, just understanding some different real estate strategies, whether you're interested in potentially being active or passive, feel free to reach out. Happy to connect.
Thanks, Marcus. Appreciate the time.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you found this content valuable, here's 3 ways I can help you achieve your career goals for free. First, subscribe to this podcast as I post 2 episodes a week. Number 2, leave a 5-star review as this helps build the credibility of the show so we can gain access to more influential people to interview and bring those lessons to you to help elevate your career. And number 3, connect with me on social media. There's a link in the show notes for you to click on that compiles all my active social media accounts, making it easy for you to find me and connect with me. Thank you again for listening, and until next time.